All right. Thank you, Marcus, for the introduction, and thank you to the organizers in general for the invitation. First, a disclaimer. So as Marcus pointed out, I did plan to go after Rüdiger Schock, so some things that I will gloss over, I assumed that you would have seen in depth. So my recommendation is, after you see Rüdiger's talk, you should hop into a wormhole and then see my talk after that. So you may need to wait to get some full answers on a couple things, but for the most part, they're independent. Secondly, I have an acronym in my title. It's actually done correctly in the listing, but I should tell you the full title. SEEK stands for Symmetric Informationally Complete Measurement. So they identify the essential difference between classical and quantum. I will define SEEK soon, so don't worry if you haven't heard the term before. But as a brief preview of what you're going to see, I'm going to present an optimality result for probabilistic representations of the Born rule. So in particular, we're going to see that the SEEKs define a representation which gets as close as possible to classical statistical physics in two senses. And my goal overall is to convince you that the SEEKs can tell us something about what the best way to understand what being quantum physically means. Okay, so let's start from the beginning, which is E.T. James and an omelet, which is, of course, a reference to a quote that he's well known for, and many of you, I'm sure, have heard before. So I'm going to read it because I can't say it better than James. So he says, "Our present quantum mechanical formalism is a peculiar mixture describing in part realities of nature, in part incomplete human information about nature, all scrambled up by Heisenberg and Bohr into an omelet that nobody has seen how to unscramble. Yet we think the unscrambling is a prerequisite for any further advance in basic physical theory. For if we cannot separate the subjective from the objective aspects of the formalism, we cannot know what we are talking about. It is just that simple." So I suppose more properly I should say that he's looking at quantum theory, and quantum theory is itself an omelet scrambled up by these two. So this is why we should look for other representations, because we want to separate subjective from the objective. One, perhaps I think the most promising general strategy is to look for probabilistic representations, because if we have one of those, then the probabilities would be the subjective part. The way they fit together would be about nature. So probabilities, broadly, loosely speaking, and also there will be more information from Rüdiger later, would be about our expectations or our information or our beliefs about us. Whereas how they fit together, so how they, the way that you should strive to have them sort of fit together formulaically would be then about nature. So that's all fine and good to say we want a probabilistic representation, but actually doing so, we have to first heed a warning from Bill Wooters, pictured here. So he says, "It is obviously possible to devise a formulation of quantum theory or quantum mechanics without probability amplitudes. One is never forced to use any quantities in one's theory other than the raw results of measurements. However, there is no reason to expect such a formulation to be anything other than extremely ugly." And I think probably your intuition would be that if we tried to use just probabilities to talk about quantum theory, then it would get extremely ugly. So just to further elaborate on what I mean when I say probabilities, and this is in particular what you're going to see a lot more with from Rüdiger, I'm talking about personalist subjective Bayesian probabilities. So in that school of thought, which was mostly developed, or at least originally developed, by Bruno De Finetti, there's a picture of him when he was really young, probabilities are not given by nature. So instead, what you mean by a probability is you mean that agent's degrees of belief, in particular gambling commitments, and that's always what you mean. So that's what a probability means, full stop. So let's just assume we're on board with that for now. And So the way it's actually formulated by De Finetti is in terms of gambling, as I said. So the meaning of a probability for him is that it is the price you are willing to buy or sell a ticket worth $1 if the event occurs. So when you're ambivalent about the price, that's your probability. So being subjective, you say, well, that's not enough constraints. Suddenly, you know, nothing means anything because I could set any probability. It's just what I think. Well, that's not the case, because what you should try to do is you should try to be consistent with yourself. So it turns out that the standard probabilistic rules for how probability calculus works arise from consistency among simultaneous gambling commitments. So if you demand that, if you really work hard to be consistent with yourself, then you become ever more in accordance with the standard probabilistic rules. And then just one additional caveat here, since we're using the word Bayesian, and that carries a lot of baggage for a lot of people, I just want to be clear that I'm not talking about Bayesian inference. So with additional assumptions beyond what the meaning of probability is about, one can derive rules of inference, for example, Bayes' rule, or how you might dynamically update your probabilities, but that's not the subject of this talk. Okay. So here's an example. Simple situation. Just to demonstrate what that probabilistic situation means. So let A be a lottery ticket worth $1 if it snows today, and $0 if it doesn't. And B is a lottery ticket that's the reverse of that, so you get $1 if it doesn't snow. If you found yourself willing to pay price for lottery ticket A of 60 cents and a price for lottery ticket B of 90 cents, then your expected net gain, if someone said, well, buy both of these, you're ambivalent after all, buy both of those tickets at that price, would be, as you can see below here, a loss of 50 cents. So you're not being consistent with yourself, because you're just going to lose money in the sense that you should try to avoid losing money. You're not being consistent with yourself. And the picture here is April 6th in Boston, when it snowed recently. And I probably would have bet a lot of money that it wouldn't have snowed, but it did. So it just goes to show you that my expectations don't tell reality what to do. Okay, and now crucially, the most important consequence of this consistency condition that I want to draw your attention to is the law of total probability. So what is the law of total probability? It's the situation that I'm sure you've all seen before, where you say that the probability for one event is equal to the average of the conditionals, as you can see up here. So you're averaging over these probabilities. It is a consequence of the consistency that I'm talking about among one's expectations for two consecutive measurements. So if you are actually planning to make a measurement and get some outcome hi, you have some expectations about that, and then you're planning to make a measurement of some property d, and you have conditional probabilities given that you have gotten one of the hi outcomes, then from the start, you can say, well, then my probability for getting outcome DI is related in this way. I should further tell you that within this probabilistic school of thought, the meaning of a conditional probability is very similar. There's just one additional little restriction. So the conditional probability is the price you're willing to buy or sell a ticket worth $1 if DI occurs. In a second action, which is refunded if you don't get the first one. So that's how you condition on the fact that we're only talking about the situation when you get a particular HJ. So just as in the previous situation where exhaustive probabilities had to sum to unity, your probabilities have to be related in this way, or a bookie could get you to lose money for sure. You're not being consistent with yourself. You have to strive to adhere to this. And that's the takeaway for the next part. So, okay. It's great to say that all probabilities are not given by nature, but I'm sure a lot of you are saying, well, but some probabilities are given by nature, right? Because Born rule gives you probabilities. Given a quantum state rho and a generalized measurement, P of M, So all right, you could also think about in terms of projective measurements, but POVM is the general setting. Then the probability of getting EI is just trace rho EI. So it looks like that's a machine that you plug in the objects from the theory and it pops out the right probability. So okay, maybe this probabilistic stuff is good in some sort of social sense, but when we get to real science, it all breaks down and probabilities are objective. But what if we didn't? What if we didn't concede that point and said, "Well, instead, probabilities are personal judgments. I'm going to stick to my guns." Then the way you can reinterpret the Born rule is say that the Born rule is instead all involving objects that are some expression of or encoding of your personal judgments. So if probabilities are personal judgments, then rho, the density matrix in general, must be an expression or an encoding of a personal judgment. And also the association between the actual experience that your probability is a representation of your belief of must also be personal judgments. Okay, but the Born rule, so that might be what the Born rule means, or that's what the terms in the Born rule are. But the fact that we can use the Born rule in the way we can with any density matrix and any measurement means that what the Born rule is doing is it's allowing us to relate probabilities in different contexts. So it's telling us another way that probabilities have to hold together, just like the law of total probability told us. Okay, so it's a different kind of situation, because in the law of total probability, it's purely a consequence of consistency. It's basically logic. You have to make sure that consecutive measurements, your probabilities hold together in this way. Whereas this is talking about different contexts. But in function, it's the same concept. It's telling us how our probabilities have to relate, otherwise we're being inconsistent. In this case, we're being inconsistent with our known laws of quantum mechanics. Okay, so if in fact it is something that tells us how probabilities hold together in that kind of a way, then the Born rule is a candidate for a probabilistic representation. Okay, so great. Now the main question is, before we try to make it into a representation, is, well, is it going to be ugly? So I say not always. And to tell you why not, first I need to tell you about meeks. So remember in the title of the talk, I had the word seek. Well, a meek is a general family that has the seeks as a special case. So a minimal informationally complete POVM is, first of all, it's a POVM. So that means it's a generalized quantum measurement, a set of positive semi-definite operators that sum to the identity. It's informationally complete, which means that it spans the operator space. So importantly, you can't just have the projectors that are the spectrum of an observable in the standard textbook quantum mechanics situation. And in particular, we certainly don't just have d of them, we exactly have d squared, because that's what the minimal condition means. So we're saying that not only does it span, but it's a basis. Okay? So a minimal informationally complete POVM is an operator basis, which happens to be a POVM. Okay? So now, on our way to making a representation that isn't ugly, enter the seeks. So let me define them. First, consider a set of rank one projectors such that their pairwise Hilbert-Schmidt inner product is equal. So if I and j in this function, in this expression here, are the same, then it equals one, because that's just the trace of a projector. But if they're different, then we get 1/d+1 for all of the different pairs. So if you can find one of these, then they form a meek if you rescale the projectors by 1/d. Called a symmetric informationally complete POVM. And the picture I have here is showing a regular tetrahedron inscribed in the block ball, because for dimension two, if we choose the projectors to be any regular tetrahedron, then they actually form a meek. So that's one very easy way to construct one, but it turns out they're very hard to construct in general. Okay, so let's say that we actually use that meek, the seeks, and we take advantage of the fact that it is an operator basis. So since it's a basis, we can expand any density matrix rho in terms of the projectors ii. And if you do that, then you find, without too much work, that the coefficients are very simple and directly related to the Born rule probabilities for making a seek measurement, if you were to do that. So P of HI are the regular Born rule probabilities for getting outcome HI. Okay, so that's the expansion. If we then consider another arbitrary measurement, so I guess I should have curly braces around DJ, but it's another POVM, then the probability for outcome J, also given by the Born rule, would just be trace rho DJ. And then on the other side, we could write it in terms of this expansion like this. Okay, so there's a way to interpret that last term, trace pi I DJ, as follows. Imagine someone performed a seek measurement on your density matrix rho, and they obtained outcome I. Then if they were committed to Luder's rule, then they would actually update to the state pi I. So pi I is a projector, it's a valid quantum state. And in that case, we could interpret trace pi I dj as the probability, conditional probability of dj, given that you got outcome hi. So if we do that, then we end up with this rather pleasing representation, which follows purely from the Born rule and totally removed from consideration as fundamental entities, the density matrix and the POVM elements. So it's all the probabilities Q of DJ, which are the probabilities for making a DJ measurement for some quantum state, are now equal to this this mixture of the probabilities for making a measurement of the seek, and then the conditional probabilities for making your DJ measurement after having gotten some seek measurement. And a nice fact about this is that they end up being just an affine transformation of the probability vector in the expression. And you get probabilities for one measurement in terms of probabilities and conditional probabilities for another, which is very reminiscent of the law of total probability. Okay, so that was pretty special, but there are more ways seeks are special. In fact, they've been special a lot of time in a lot of different ways. Here are a few. So in dimensions where a seek exists, and I should mention that it's not proven they exist in general, although it does seem that they exist in general. It's an open problem. In all dimensions that serious effort has gone into finding them, they've been found so far. So in those dimensions where they exist, they are optimal measurements for quantum state tomography. Even when you don't have a complete set of mutually unbiased bases, if you don't know what those are, don't worry. But if you do know what those are, then you know that it seems unlikely that they exist in a lot of dimensions. So seeks do seem to exist in every dimension, and they would be optimal for quantum state tomography. The seeks are most sensitive to quantum eavesdropping. They may be used as magic states in quantum computation. They are a defining feature of the Singapore protocol for quantum key distribution. So they're special and optimal in lots of ways. But this guy we had here at the bottom has featured heavily in Cubist literature in the last 10 years or so. But actually deciding to use it, deciding to represent the Born rule with the seeks, was made on aesthetic grounds. So it looked pretty, seemed like, well, probably there's not going to be a representation that's cleaner than that or more beautiful than that, because after all, Luder says that they're likely to be ugly. But maybe we can actually prove that the seek representation is optimal in some sense as well. Okay. So to do that, we need a general scenario that may include the seek case as a special case. So the thing that wasn't general about what we did before was we made a seek measurement, and then we updated to the seek state. Well, what if we don't demand that we are making a seek measurement, and we don't demand that we update to, well, the seek state, or even the state that is proportional? So consider a reference process consisting of first a meek measurement, and then upon outcome I, the preparation of a state sigma I from a linearly independent set. So just completely two separate operator bases. One's a set of density matrices, and the other's meek elements. And your reference process is you make one measurement, you update to the other. in the special case where the HI and sigma I are rank one and they are proportional to each other, then this would be the same outcome as what you would get from an application of Luder's rule. So it's just, it's good to note that special case. Okay, so here's a diagram of the situation. There's two different paths you can follow. So up in the sky there, we have our reference process. So the HI is a big measurement device. You feed in your quantum state, it gives you some reading, and then depending on which reading, which I you get, you then prepare quantum state sigma I here, which gets fed into your DJ measurement box. And you're comparing the probabilities and conditional probabilities for that process to what probabilities you would get if you just directly threw it in to your measurement box. So what we're looking for, just as in the previous case, is a relation between this, this, and this, but in the general scenario. Where, of course, if we ignore this line and just said, we're definitely doing the dotted path, then your probabilities have to hold together like the law of total probability. Because, yes?
The PHI is set by the quantum state to start with,
right? It would be, but yes. Yeah, so you, in order to make this in accordance with quantum theory, then yeah. But maybe in a far future reformulation or reconstruction of quantum theory, you could not make any reference to the density matrix at all.
Yeah,
it would be completely arbitrary. Right, right. Yeah, actually, we'll see some consequences of that. Right, so I just wanted to mention that if you're purely talking about the case where you're going along the dotted path, then P of HI, P of D of HI, would be related to your probability for doing this and then getting that and calling the outcome P of DJ as the law of total probability. So only when we're relating two different experimental procedures do we get something that's different from the law of total probability. Okay, so let's repeat the derivation from earlier. So now we expand in terms of post-measurement states, sigma J. So we have some alpha J's for those coefficients. Let's calculate the Born rule probability for outcome HI. So that's the Born rule. And then on this side, it's this. And then I define this matrix phi via its inverse, which is just from this part right here, the inner product of HI and sigma J. And since the sigma J's and the HI's are linearly independent, that matrix is invertible. We can write down the vector of alphas in terms of phi times the vector of probabilities, and we can get this expansion of rho. Okay, and then similar to before, we consider an arbitrary POVM, DJ, calculate those Born rule probabilities, and we end up with this, where we've once again interpreted the conditional probability in that way. Looking at this, you can see that here's a matrix, there's a matrix, and that's a vector, and the indices are such that it's actually matrix multiplication. So we could write all of this in compact vector notation as Q of D equals matrix of conditional probabilities times this matrix phi, which captures the fact, which is reference process dependent, times your probabilities for your meek outcome. Yeah.
Just a quick question. So if the phi's, the weights would be different for the different HKs, for example,
yep,
then somehow you would have to distinguish them and know which weight to assign to which one, how to label them or so. Would you also, I wonder if there's like a fundamental reason that the weights actually should be the same?
There's one concern. I mean, so the weights can be different, and I consider the case where the weights could be different. But and in general, they are different in this formulation. But if they're different, then what you would get in this mapping is that the garbage state, 1 over D times I, would not be mapped to the completely flat probability. And that would be a desirable property, I'd say. So like if you want to think of the completely mixed state as sort of complete ignorance, then you would probably want it to map to a flat probability distribution. So that's one reason to maybe restrict your search just to equal weight meeks. But, you know, I wanted to not restrict my search at all. And so I don't restrict my search at all. So we allow arbitrarily weighted meeks and everything. Okay, so there it is, the picture again, and now we see this is the formula for relating your probabilities and conditional probabilities, and this phi matrix appears. Okay, so how do we interpret that? The way to interpret it is that it's telling us something about what's different in the case where we've decided to do the measurement in the sky versus when we haven't decided to do a measurement in the sky. So if you do it, the measurement in the sky, then you use the law of total probability. If you don't, use this Born rule probability meshing equation, which could reasonably be called a law of total probability analog. Because look, this matrix here, the fact that it's not the identity is the reason that it's not the same thing as just doing the law of total probability. So a fact about phi is that it's column quasi-stochastic. What that means is that the columns of the matrix are real valued and they sum to one, but they don't have to all be between 0 and 1, which is what a regular stochastic matrix would be. In fact, they necessarily have some negative elements because we know that the appearance of negativity is necessary in any quasi-probability representation of quantum theory. And if we just took the product phi times p here, then that itself is a quasi-probability. And then this whole guy here times that quantity would be a quasi-probability representation. If we could eliminate all of the negativity, then, you know, that would be violating quantum mechanics. So if not only could we get rid of all the negativity, but phi could actually equal the identity, then with respect to whatever reference process I was considering when you constructed phi, there would be no strange probability meshing at all. It would look exactly like the law of total probability. And the consequence of that is we could behave as though there were actual ontic states underlying what you were measuring. So it was waiting there to be revealed by your measurement. But we know we can't do that. And one final point about these law of total probability analogs is that all of them are valid in the sense that I can choose any meek in any post-measurement set, and all of them will be the Born rule, morally speaking, and give you correct probabilities. But some of them, or most of them, will scramble the subjective and objective into a messier omelet, as Jaynes might say, than actually necessary. Right.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Which part of this line are you taking to correspond to the word objective?
Oh, objective would be the, I guess, basically the phi mixing of the probabilities and conditional probability matrices. So the way that function actually holds together, not the actual elements in it. So the probability is subjective. This conditional probability matrix is suggested subjective. That's probability matrix is subjective. But if you assign all of those in such a way that they don't satisfy that relation, then you are not being consistent with quantum theory. Does that make sense?
It does, but that still just seems like part of the framework for how you should reason, and I'm not sure why that should be labeled objective.
It is sort of a different notion of objectivity than some would have, right? It doesn't have the same character as, like, here's a little piece of metal on the table, that's objective. But it is still a candidate, I think, for some sort of normative notion of what we mean by a physical rule. Because after all, we're saying that if quantum theory is correct, then even though probabilities are subjectively ascribed by individuals, and any set of probabilities that satisfies this is fine, well, there's lots of different probability sets that will satisfy that. So there's no way to decide that one is right, the other is wrong, but unless they don't hold together that way, in which case you could be made to lose in a gambling situation. Okay. One more point that Rüdiger will cover more carefully. Just want to make a statement about the no-go theorems. So in the meek form that we've talked about, so this guy, the QD, the Born rule automatically differs from the law of total probability, which basically just means that it's automatically outside of the ontological model's framework. And all of the no-go theorems invoke law of total probability conditioning, on ontic variables, and we don't. So here are four of them that all have represented what is basically the law of total probability or joint probability, but they're summing over this lambda variable, which is some manifold of ontic states underlying everything, which we don't presuppose. This is just the law of total probability. And that, I think, is the law of total probability also, just fancily dressed up. Okay. So anyway, back to the situation at hand. If some of them will scramble it up more than others, then what's the least scrambled we could get? And one way, I mean, the way to think about that is how close can phi and the identity matrix actually be? Because if it could be the identity matrix, then the world wouldn't be quantum at all. The remaining differences between the law of total probability and a representation which is as close as possible, in quotes, would be due to genuinely non-classical properties of physical reality. Okay, so let's figure out how close they can be. One way to measure a representation's difference from the law of total probability is with an operator distance. So let's look at the operator distance between those two, or an operator distance. And in particular, let's just look at the Frobenius distance in the special case that the post-measurement states are proportional to the mean. So that isn't the general case that I was talking about, but this one is easy to show on a slide. So lo and behold, what I advertised at the beginning of the talk, the seeks are the closest. We get the following theorem. Let phi be the column quasi-stochastic matrix associated with a meek and a proportional set of post-measurement states. Then this Frobenius norm distance is lower bounded by that value with equality if and only if the meek is a seek. So for those of you who don't remember, the Frobenius norm is the Euclidean norm of the vector of singular values. Okay, so let's just show a sketch of the proof.
Can I understand the theorem again, or the statement? So if it's not a seek, is the bound worse? Is that the point? Or?
If it's not a seek, then this distance is going to be bigger than that value.
Oh, with equality, okay, I missed it.
Sorry, yeah. So we can first just bound the square of the Frobenius distance below with something that only involves the trace of the matrix itself. Okay, I won't show the details of that. And now also note that from the definition of phi inverse, we can get the an upper bound on the sum of the reciprocals of the eigenvalues. So looking back at the definition of that, the trace of it is equal to this. And then that's upper bounded by the trace, I mean, by just the sums of the HIs, where the HIs are the weights, as Marcus mentioned. The weights always have to sum to D, so we've upper bounded the trace of phi inverse, or the sum of the eigenvalues of the reciprocals of the eigenvalues of phi by D. And then furthermore, phi inverse is a column stochastic matrix, which means that its largest eigenvalue is 1. For sure. So we can take out 1 from that sum and say that the reciprocal is bounded above when you sum over just d squared minus 1 of them by d minus 1. So then you recall the ordering of the Pythagorean means, which tells you that the arithmetic mean is greater than or equal to the geometric mean, which is greater than or equal to the harmonic mean, all equality if and only if they are all the xi's are equal. So if we have that, then we can write an expression in terms of the arithmetic mean and the harmonic mean, and using the previous inequality, actually get an exact lower bound for trace phi, which just from checking the seek value is achieved by the seek value. So this, of course, doesn't show the equality if and only if, but it does show you that the seek value gets that, and it shows you that the lower bound, when you plug in this into this guy, it gets you the theorem statement squared. Okay, so we can actually prove a much stronger result. And in order to do it, I want to first review the theory of majorization, or in some cases, introduce the theory of majorization if you haven't heard of it. Okay, so we say that a vector x weakly majorizes a vector y, which is denoted like this, with that funky symbol. If all of the partial sums for one vector are greater than or equal to all the partial sums for the other vector when they've been arranged in descending order, that's what this down arrow means. If the last inequality is an equality, then we say X majorizes Y, and it's just denoted without the W. The intuition for majorization that you might want to keep in mind is that if X majorizes Y, then Y is a flatter matrix, a flatter vector than X. So that's the thing to keep in mind. There's actually another notion of majorization. I think it's usually called log majorization. Sometimes I've seen multiplicative majorization. So we say that a vector X weakly log majorizes a vector Y, which is denoted same way with a log down there, if instead of the partial sums, we have the partial products. So that's pretty self-explanatory. If the last inequality is an equality, then we say that X log majorizes Y, denoted like this. Okay, the reason why that for the two terminologies is that log majorization is majorization between vectors after an element-wise application of the log map, because the log will turn products into sums. Also, log majorization implies regular majorization, but the reverse implication isn't true. And then something we'll need, I'll point out that was used later, is the fact that majorization is a partial order on vectors of real numbers in descending order. Okay, so we have majorization out of the way. Let me just tell you some notation. The phi matrix, I'm just going to call the phi matrix associated with the special case that I talked about at the beginning of the talk, with a seek measurement and proportional seek outcome, seek update, is just going to be denoted phi seek. And then S of A is the vector of singular values of a matrix A sorted in descending order. All right, so with that, we can state the much better thing, or the lemma that allows us to get something that's much better. Let phi be the column quasi-stochastic matrix associated with an arbitrary reference process, which means arbitrary meek and arbitrary post-measurement states. They don't have to be proportional anymore. Then the singular values of phi weakly log majorize the singular values of phi c. And once again, we have equality if and only if. But in this case, there's a small difference between the if and only if case, because we have if and only if the meek and post-measurement states are seeks, but there's no requirement that they are the same seek. Of course, if they are the same seek, then you get the situation we had at the beginning of the talk, but actually, they just both need to be seeks. It doesn't matter whether they're the same. So here's a quick sketch of the proof for that. I crammed most of the proof actually into the first statement, which took a significant amount of work to realize the lower bound of the absolute value of the determinant of phi. The reason that it was hard to lower bound that is because phi in general is not the kind of matrix that physicists are used to working with. It's not Hermitian. In fact, it's not even normal in general. So I'm sure a mathematician wouldn't have to, but I had to dig into matrix analysis textbooks to figure out what still could be said about them. So once we have that lower bound, so the seek value is the lower bound among all possible situations, then also note that for any matrix, the singular values log majorize the absolute spectrum. Then I would like to show that the absolute spectrum weakly log majorizes the spectrum of phi seek. And to show that, I can just show that the log of the absolute spectrum weakly majorizes the log of the spectrum of phi seek. So this one exactly majorizes this vector here, which is just the flattest vector that has the same sum and the required last element. Remember, one of the eigenvalues has to be 1, so the log of it is 0. The sum of the logs becomes the log of the product. The product is the determinant when we stick in the last eigenvalue of 1. And then we use this property to lower bound this for a weak majorization. And then substituting in the seek value, we actually get log of lambda phi seek. So, yes.
What's the
example of
phi
defined? Yeah. Phi, way back in the beginning, was defined via the inverse of this. So I define it from the inverse of the matrix where each element is the inner product of your meek element and another one of the post-measurement state elements.
Okay, so Aj and sigma j are rank one positive semi-definite matrices?
No, not necessarily. So I make no assumption about rank. The only thing that is confirmed here is that the sum of all the Hi's is the identity. They are positive semi-definite, they need not be rank one. In fact, they can be all rank one. They are all rank one in the Seek case. And the sigma I's are all trace normalized, so they're all quantum states. They all have to have trace one, and they are also positive semi-definite, but nothing needs to be rank one for these considerations.
Okay, so at least minus one is symmetric and not negative.
It doesn't have to be symmetric, because if the sigma j are a different set than the hi and not even proportional to each other, then the transpose is not equal to the to itself. Because the transpose element would be Hj sigma I, right? And they're different in general. So it's not even a symmetric matrix. It's not Hermitian. The eigenvalues can be complex.
It's non-negative. It's a non-negative matrix.
This is a non-negative matrix. Because the elements of the matrix are just these inner products of positive semi-definite things. The inverse has negative elements, but they're all real. Any other questions about phi? It is kind of a strange construction. Okay. And just the last part here. So after we had that, then we can say the singular values log majorize the absolute spectrum, which weakly log majorizes the spectrum, which is equal to the singular values, because in the Seek case, it is symmetric. It is positive definite. It is everything's nice. So ultimately, we get the desired relation. Again, I haven't proven equality if and only if, but believe me, it can be done. There will be a paper up soon containing it. But anyway, with log majorization, or rather any majorization, really, then you open the door to a lot of optimality results because of the partial order situation. So mathematicians back in the day proved a lot of things are monotone with respect to the partial order of weak majorization, for instance. And so what we get is, instead of just a Frobenius norm, we get all unitarily invariant norms. So, and it's also for a general arbitrary reference process. So first, a unitarily invariant norm is one such that the norm of A is equal to the norm of U, A, V, where U and V are arbitrary unitary matrices. And so the theorem is this. Let phi be a column quasi-stochastic matrix associated with an arbitrary reference process. Again, any arbitrary meek and arbitrary post-measurement set. Then for any unitarily invariant norm, this guy, we have that it's lower bounded by the Seek distance. And we have equality if and only if. Yes?
Just one thing puzzles me now. So we had an affine map in the beginning.
Yep.
This is -1 over D, but this is a linear map.
I don't switch between it. It ends up being an affine transformation. Well, yeah, for in the Seek case. I guess maybe affine is the wrong word, but the phi matrix is very simple in the Seek case, and so I didn't need this double sum, and I didn't need to represent it as matrix multiplication times matrix multiplication. It could just be, I could just write out, the probability vector that got multiplied, or the quasi-probability vector that got multiplied by the conditional probability matrix could be represented with a single index in terms of the P of Hi's. So this one is a sub. I mean, in general, it's not such a simple relation, right? I guess this. People need to be looking at the definition of phi and look at the Seek case and just see how they are actually aligned. So we can do that later. So we have equality if and only if the meek and the Seeks are Seeks. The meek and the post-measurement states are Seeks. Again, they don't have to be the same Seek, but they do have to be Seeks. So the unitarily invariant norms include basically every norm I've ever seen a physicist care about. So all the Schottenpeake norms, which include the trace norm, the Frobenius norm, the operator norm, the Kaifan K norms, which are the sum of the first K singular values. Basically, the singular value theme is important because any norm that depends only on singular values will be unitarily invariant. Okay, majorization actually keeps giving in a sense that we can see through another notion of deviation from classicality. So the thing to imagine here is that in the classical case, you might say to yourself, when you're predicting the outcomes of an experiment, you might say, well, I know what the real state of affairs is. So that means I have probability one for this outcome and zero probability for all the other outcomes. So in other words, you have the full simplex, however many outcomes there are, full simplexes available to you. In contrast, if you're using the Born rule to map quantum state space, represented by this blob, to via the Born rule to a probability vector, then you don't have the full simplex. No outcome of a Meek measurement can have probability one. You can get arbitrarily close for some of them, but when you do that for your Meek, then you get really, really far away from the possibility of one for all of your others. So you get squished and stretched. Some region, script P here, is a proper subset of the probability simplex. That naturally motivates a notion of deviation from classicality, which is different from this operator distance one that I was talking about earlier, wherein you might say, well, whichever Meek maps quantum state space to the largest volume or the largest region inside the simplex is the one that is closest to the classical situation. So lo and behold, the majorization result, a consequence of it also, is that the Seek Meek wins that race also. So for any Meek in dimension D, let script P denote the image of quantum state space under the Born rule, and let volume of E of P denote its Euclidean volume. Then the Euclidean volume of any Meek script P is less than or equal to the Euclidean volume of script P Seek, with equality if and only if, once again, the Meek is a Seek. So in two senses, the Seeks give you the least deviation from classicality within quantum theory. They give you the largest possible volume in this mapping. So that's basically what I've done. And some future work would be similarly motivated search for optimal representations of general quantum time evolutions instead of what we just talked about, which was all about measurements. If the results can coincide, that would give even stronger motivation for looking into the Seeks as a hint for what being quantum physically means. Another thing that has actually been underway already is a full quantum reconstruction, taking that first guy, the Seek expression of the law of total probability, sometimes called the Urgleichung, as one of the axioms. So progress has been made about on that. I refer you to this paper by Appleby, Fuchs, Schuck, and Zhu, Introducing the Q-plex, a Novel Arena for Quantum Theory. So they made a lot of progress, but the last few assumptions that they've invoked to get all the way to quantum theory are probably stronger than necessary. So we'd like to weaken those. And then finally, the connection between quasi-probability representations and phi may lead to a way to move between each, may unlock more things about quasi-probabilities, which is an active area of research. So I'd like to connect what I'm doing to them. For more information about Seeks, see this paper. So this paper tells you all about the history of the problem and the current state of the art for the solutions that have been found. So it wasn't part of this talk really, but as I did say, it's not known in principle that they exist in all dimensions, but we have quite a few. And then of course, my image credits. So that's all I have, thank you.
Sorry, I forgot. Which one of the two was positive,
non-negative?
Phi to the minus one or phi?
Phi to the minus one is a non-negative matrix, yeah.
I believe that this sort of non-negative matrices has been studied in the
yes.
literature of
yes. biology. Oh, in biology, okay. I didn't know about
they
that.
They are called M matrices.
Okay, yes. I didn't know it was in biology, but I saw a wiki page on M matrices. I thought they had some extra restriction, like the something about the diagonal or...
It's very cool because the inverse can be written as a constant times the identity minus another non-negative matrix.
Yes. I remember that result, yes.
The diagonal has to be zero or negative,
mm-hmm.
and the diagonal has to be positive.
Yeah.
And people in biology have studied them a lot.
Okay,
there's
yeah.
There's a book with the...
Book all about them. Yeah. Yeah, I've seen some of that stuff. Most of my the results that I used didn't involve specific study of M matrices because I think I remember, or maybe I don't know it now because I don't remember the definition of an M matrix, but I think some of the phis weren't M matrices, although some could be. So, but thank you. That's good. For now.
So you mentioned that of these recent attempts to reconstruct quantum theory from these type of formulas. So I was trying to guess what the actions could be in terms of this phi matrix. But of course, this begs the question of what is the interpretation of that matrix within your framework? I think there was a question already during the talk about in what sense that is the objective part, like the world outside.
Right.
So like what is your take on that?
So what
kind of axioms should we expect to see in terms of this
fight? What they do, first of all, what I did was I started with quantum theory and sort of tried to go in the direction of something that isn't quantum theory but is consistent with it. What they're trying to do is go the other direction, start from something that isn't quantum theory and show what it takes to become quantum theory, right? And in their case, they didn't take the phi seq as their axiom, but they took a family that included it, which isn't technically constructed in exactly the same way. So in a sense, what I've done is give added justification to that starting point, but the interpretation of it, it's just the way that you have to probabilistically mix your probabilities together. And the particular phi seq is the one that happens in the quantum mechanics case, they replace the d plus 1 and 1 over d with alpha and beta.
One example of axiom could be, given the other constraint, I choose the phi that brings me as close as possible to a classical update rule.
They don't even start at that stage because, I mean, first of all, that was written before I did this work. They just were already assuming that the seq case was of particular interest. And so they're restricting to a family that looks very similar to that one from the start. It's not necessarily motivated from the inner product of two positive semi-definite sets inverted and all this stuff. But the additional assumptions they needed, at least one of them was something about projective unitary group. So that's already pretty strong, right?
but I mean, it is true. I mean, being one of the authors of earlier versions of this argument, it is true that the motivation for this particular form, this alpha and beta, is supposed to be a simple affine modification of the Born rule. So that certainly is a modification.
True.
So being close to the Born rule.
To the law of total probability. Law of total probability.
A simple affine modification of the law of total probability. Because obviously, your Born rule is, you don't use any quantum mechanics in that, but simply probability.
One of your earlier slides had this remark at the bottom that other POVMs than SIG POVMs mix up objective and subjective things.
Ah, okay.
Was your talk supposed to show that? I didn't quite...
sort of. Basically, the point is that if I choose a reference process that involves a meek, arbitrarily chosen, and a set of post-measurement states, sigma j, and they aren't both proportional seqs, then you're going to get something that is farther away from the law of total probability in the two senses that I've proven.
Okay, that's
it. Yeah, in that sense, it's more scrambled. And then what I pointed out here, so once we're as close as possible, then we don't need to worry about whether there's some strange meshing going on that's just because we've chosen a poor representation, right? Because you could imagine a world that was classical and you do all the same stuff. You just have the question is what you should measure, and you find some phi matrix. You represent things with some phi matrix, but it could be that the phi matrix is actually allowed to go all the way down to the identity. If you choose something that isn't the identity, then it's sort of harder to see what the ontic variable underneath actually is, because in the case where it could go to the identity, there could be an ontic variable. So I assert that you should always try to get as close as possible to the identity, and then that's a good candidate vantage point. Yeah.
So in that representation inside a simplex, like the thing you talked about.
The last part?
Yeah. So is it the case that the vertices of the simplex are the basically, in some sense, deterministic distributions over the outcomes or something like that?
If you could get...
Like it's if you point inside as an arbitrary distribution over.
Yeah, so the simplex I've represented is just a tetrahedron here, but in general, the corners of the simplex would be one outcome is one, the other outcome, yeah, they're probability one, the others are zero. But that's not a valid quantum state.
And then the task is to identify what points inside that correspond to quantum states.
Yeah.
And the thing you said was that if you were to choose a meek that's not a seek, the Euclidean volume is going to be smaller than the seek representation.
Yes.
Does this tie up with like the stuff about the phi matrix? Like if that was identity, would you say that if you can access the whole simplex?
Yes. If it were the identity, you could get the whole simplex, okay. Yeah.
Okay, so there will be another quick break, but let's thank the speaker here.